This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents Nice Girls Don't Have Fangs, written by Molly Harper and narrated by Amanda Ronconi.
Chapter 1. Vampirism. Noun. 1. The condition of being a vampire, marked by the need to ingest blood and extreme vulnerability to sunlight. 2. The act of preying upon others for financial or emotional gain. 3. A gigantic pain in the butt. I've always been a glass-half-full kind of girl. The irritated look from Gary, the barrel-chested bartender at Shenanigans, told me that, 1, I'd said that out loud, and 2, he just didn't care. But at that point, I was the only person sitting at the pseudo-sports bar on a Wednesday afternoon, and I didn't have the cognitive control required to stop talking. So he had no choice but to listen. I picked up the remnants of my 4th, 5th, 6th electric lemonade. It glowed blue against the neon lights of Shenanigans' insistently cheerful decor, casting a green shadow on Gary's yellow and white striped polo shirt. See this glass? This morning, I would have said, this glass isn't half empty, it's half full. And I was used to that. My whole life has been half full. Half full family, half full personal life, half full career. But I settled for it. I was used to it. Did I already say that I was used to it? Gary, a gondoseed high school football player with a gut like a deflated balloon, gave me a stern look over the pilsner he was polishing. Are you done with that? I drained the watered-down vodka and blue liqueur from my glass, wincing as the alcohol hit the potato skins in my belly. Both threatened to make an encore appearance. I steadied myself on the ring-stained maple bar and squinted through the icy remains of the glass. And now? My career is gone. Gone, gone, gone. Completely empty. Like this glass. Gary replaced said glass with another drink, pretended to wave at someone in the main dining room, and left me to fend for myself. I pressed my forehead to the cool wood of the bar, cringing as I remembered the smug cat that devoured the canary tone Mrs. Stubblefield used to say, Jane, I need to speak with you privately. For the rest of my life, those words would echo through my head like something out of Carrie. With a loud ahem, Mrs. Stubblefield motioned for me to leave my display of Amelia Bedelia books and come into her office. Actually, all she did was quirk her eyebrows. But the woman had a phobia about tweezers. When she was surprised, angry, curious, it looked as if a big gray moth was taking flight. Quirking her brows was practically sign language. My joyless hun of a supervisor only spoke to people privately when they were in serious trouble. Generally, she enjoyed chastising in public in order to A, show the staff just how badly she could embarrass us if she wanted to, and B, show the public how put upon she was by her rotten, incompetent employees. Mrs. Stubblefield had never been a fan of mine. We got off on the wrong foot when I made fun of the Mother Goose hat she wore for toddler story hour. I was 4. She was the type of librarian who has, reading is supposed to be educational, not fun, tattooed somewhere. She refused to order DVDs or video games that might attract the wrong crowd. Translation, teenagers. She allowed the library to stock questionable books such as The Catcher in the Rye and the Harry Potter series, but tracked who read them. She kept those names in a file marked Potential Troublemakers.
Close the door, Jane,
she said, squeezing into her desk chair. Mrs. Stubblefield was about 1 cheek too large for it, but refused to order another one. A petty part of me enjoyed her discomfort while I prepared for a lecture on appropriate displays for Banned Books Week or why we really didn't need to stock audiobooks on CD.
As you know, Jane, the county commission cut our operating budget by 20% for the next fiscal year, Mrs. Stubblefield said. That leaves us with less money for new selections and new programs.
I'd be willing to give up Puppet Time Theater on Thursdays, I offered. I secretly hated Cowboy Bob and his puppets. I have puppet issues.
I'm afraid it's more serious than that, Jane,
Mrs. Stubblefield said, her eyes flitting to the glass door behind me.
We have to reduce our salary expenses as well. I'm afraid we can't afford a director of juvenile services anymore. We're going to have to let you go.
Maybe some of you saw that coming, but I didn't. I got my master's degree in library science, knowing I would come back to my library, even if it meant working with Mrs. Stubblefield. I'm the one who established the library's book club for new mothers who desperately needed to leave the house on Thursday nights for a little adult conversation. I'm also the reason a small portion of the Hollow's female population now knows that Sense and Sensibility was a book before it was a movie. I'm the one who insisted we start doing background checks on our storytime guests, which is why Jiggles the Clown was no longer welcome on the premises. I'm the one who spent 2 weeks on my knees ripping out the 33-year-old carpet in the children's reading room. Me. So, after hearing that my services were no longer needed, I had no response other than, huh?
I'm sorry, Jane, but we have no other choice. We must be careful stewards of the taxpayers' money, Mrs. Stubblefield said, shaking her head in mock regret.
She was trying to look sympathetic, but her eyebrows were this close to doing the samba. Ida is retiring next month, I said of the ancient returns manager. Can't we save the money through eliminating her position? Clearly, Mrs. Stubblefield had not expected me to argue, which proved that she never paid attention when I spoke. Her eyebrows beat twice, which I took as code for, just leave quietly. I don't understand, I continued. My performance reviews have been nothing but positive. Juvenile circulation has increased 32% since I was hired. I work weekends and nights when everyone else is too busy or sick. This place is my whole... What the hell are you looking at? I turned to see Mrs. Stubblefield's stepdaughter, Posey, standing near the main desk. Posey waved, her bagged lunch bobbing merrily. Something told me she wasn't just early for a picnic with her wicked stepmother. Posey was virtually unemployable since she'd set fire to the Pretty Paw's pet grooming salon while blow-drying Biddy Wade's teacup poodle. Apparently, doggy nail polish, heat elements, and long-haired breeds are a cataclysmic combination. This was the third job Posey had lost due to fire, including blazes started with overcooked microwave popcorn at the video hut and a boiled dry coffee pot at the coffee spot. When Posey wasn't working, she moved back into her dad's house, which also happened to be Mrs. Stubblefield's house. Clearly, my boss had decided she could share a water cooler with Posey, but not a bathroom. I was being replaced. Replaced by someone who needed flashcards to understand the Dewey Decimal System. Replaced with someone I'd hated on principle since the sixth grade when she penned the following in my honor. Roses are red, violets are black. Why is your front as flat as your back? Thanks to middle school politics, I was labeled Plained Jane until my senior year growth spurt. Regarding the use of plained, I believe one of Posey's smarter friends showed her how to use a thesaurus. Posey spotted me and froze mid-wave. I uttered several of the 7 words you're not supposed to say in polite company. My soon-to-be former boss let out an indignant huff.
Honestly, Jane, I can't allow someone who uses that language to work around children.
You can't fire me, I told her. I'll appeal to the library board.
Who do you think signed your termination notice?
Mrs. Stubblefield preened while sliding the paper toward me. I snatched it off her desk. Your crony, Mrs. Newsom, signed the termination notice. That's not quite the same thing.
She got approval from the other board members,
Mrs. Stubblefield said.
They were very sorry to see you go, but the truth is, we just can't afford you.
But you can afford Posey?
Posey is starting as a part-time desk clerk. The salaries aren't comparable.
She starts fires, I hissed. Books tend to be kind of flammable. Ignoring me, Mrs. Stubblefield reached into a drawer to remove an envelope, which I hoped included a handsome severance and detailed instructions on how to keep health insurance and feed one large, ugly dog without bringing home a paycheck. The final indignity was Mrs. Stubblefield handing me a banker's box already packed with my personal effects. I stumbled through the lobby on legs that threatened to buckle under me. I ignored the cheerful greetings from patrons, knowing I would burst into tears at the first face I recognized. I got into my car, leaned my forehead against the white-hot steering wheel, and began to hyperventilate. After about an hour of that, I mopped my blotchy face on my sleeve and opened what I thought was my severance check. Instead, a bright yellow and white striped slip of paper drifted into my passenger seat, shouting, $25 plus free potato skins, in huge red letters. Instead of a severance check, I got a gift certificate to Shenanigans. This prompted another hour or so of hysterical crying. I finally pulled myself together enough to pull out of the library parking lot and drive toward the mall. Shenanigans was one of the first big-chain restaurants to come to Half Moon Hollow after the county commission finally unclenched its dry status. After decades of driving over county lines to Maynard to get liquor by the drink, Half Moon Hollow residents could finally enjoy cocktails close enough to walk home drunk instead of drive. Personally, I find that comforting. McClure County was one of the last counties in the state where you could legally smoke in restaurants. Thank you, local tobacco farmers. So the bar was cloaked in several layers of cigarette haze. I made myself comfortable on a bar stool, ordered some potato skins and a large electric lemonade. For those unfamiliar with the beverage, picture a glass of country time that looks like Windex and makes your face numb. After the gift certificate ran out, I handed my Visa to Gary the bartender and told him to start a tab. I switched to mudslide sometime around happy hour. An I'm-too-tired-to-cook crowd trickled in after dusk. Unfortunately, this crowd included Adam Morrow, the man whose blonde cherubic children I would one day bear, if I ever worked up the nerve to talk to him. I've had a crush on Adam since elementary school, when he sat beside me in homeroom. Thank you, alphabetical order. When we were kids, he looked like Joey McIntyre from New Kids on the Block, which is like preteen girl kryptonite. And Adam was one of the few people who never called me plain Jane, so double points for him. We moved in different circles in high school. Okay, we were barely in the same building. He was the dimpled football hero with a mysterious dash of debate team participation. I spent lunch breaks shelving library books for extra Key Club points. I didn't see him while we were away at college, but I like to think it means something that we both came back to Half Moon Hollow. I like to think that he values his roots and wants to give back to his hometown, and that it makes me less of a loser for living less than 5 miles from my parents' house. Adam's a veterinarian now. He makes his living curing puppies. I'm a woman of uncomplicated tastes. Adam smiled at me from across the bar, but he didn't come over. It was just as well, since A, he probably didn't remember my name, and B, I might have melted off my bar stool in a puddle of hammered, unemployed hussy. Plus, I've had the same reaction around Adam since our very first elementary school encounter. Total lockjaw. I cannot speak normal sentences. I can only smile, drool, and burble like an idiot, which was pretty much what I was doing at the time. Had I not suffered enough already? I considered cutting my losses and scuttling home, but I did not need to add blackout drunk driver to my already tattered reputation. Nestled in a crook of the Kentucky-Ohio River border, Half Moon Hollow is not one of those stereotypical southern towns where everybody knows everybody, we have one stoplight, and our sole cop carries his bullet around in his pocket. We had the second stoplight installed last year. And don't call it a holler, or I will personally track you down and hurt you. Of the 10,000 or so people who live in this town, I am on a first-name basis with, or related to, about half. And if I don't know you, I know your cousins. Or my parents know you, your parents, or your parents' cousins. So I was caught off guard when a complete stranger materialized on the bar stool next to me. "Hi," I said. Actually, I think I yelled in a too-loud, drunk voice. "That was unexpected."
"It usually is," said Mr. Tall, Dark, and Yummy.
He asked the bartender for the tequila sunrise special and was served in record time. As I stared at the maroon cloud swirling in the bottom of his glass, he asked if I would like another drink.
"I'm already drunk,"
I said in what I'm sure I thought was a whisper. "I probably need to switch to coffee if I'm going to get home tonight." His hesitant smile showed perfectly even, almost unnaturally white teeth. "He probably suffers an addiction to tooth whitener," I mused. He seemed to take pretty good care of his skin as well. "Hair?"
longish, winding in dark, curling locks from a slight widow's peak to his strong, square chin. Eyes, deep gray, almost silver, with a dark charcoal ring around the irises. Clothes, dark, well-cut, and out of place in the shenanigans crowd. Preliminary judgment? Definitely a metrosexual, possibly gay, with a spontaneous yen for mozzarella sticks.
"What's your name?" Mr. Yummy asked, signaling the bartender to get me a cup of coffee.
"Jane Jameson," I said, extending my hand. He shook it with hands that were smooth and cool. I thought that he must moisturize like crazy. And then I started to babble. "It's mind-blowingly boring, I know. Why don't I just go completely bland and change my last name to Smith or blank? Or why not do the mature thing and go by my middle name?"
"Well, you'd have to be crazy to go by my middle name."
"And what is that?" he asked.
"Enid," I said, grimacing. "After a distant relative. My dad thought it was really original because no one else had a daughter named Enid. I guess it hadn't occurred to him why nobody else had a daughter named Enid. I think Mama was still hopped up on the epidural because she agreed to it."
"Purity," he said. I think I squinted at him because he repeated himself. "Enid is Welsh in origin. It means purity, or soul." It also meant there were a lot of jokes at my expense when our full names were announced at school, I muttered sulkily. The coffee was a bitter black jolt to the system after frothy frozen cocktails. I shuddered. Graduations were hell. He paused for a moment, and then laughed. A good explosion of honest, barking laughter. It sounded rusty, as if he hadn't done that in a while.
"Jane Enid Jameson, my name is Gabriel Nightingale," he said. "I would very much like to keep you company until you are able to drive home."
I wish I could remember that first conversation with Gabriel, but mighty Lord Kahlua prevents it. From what I can piece together, I gave him the gory details of my firing. I think I impressed him by explaining that the term firing came from ancient Britannic clans. When village elders wanted to get rid of someone, instead of accusing him of witchcraft or shunning him, they would burn down the undesirable's house and force him to move on. I don't know how this stuff sticks in my head. It just does. We eventually wandered into a discussion of English literature. Gabriel expressed affection for Robert Burns, whom I deemed too lazy to spell correctly. I would feel bad, but he called my beloved Ms. Austin a repressed, uptight spinster. I was provoked. We called a truce and decided to discuss a much more neutral subject. Religion. It took several hours, but I sobered up considerably. Still, I was reluctant to leave. Here was a person who didn't know me before my life was turned upside down. He couldn't compare the before and after Jane. He didn't know me well enough to feel sorry for me. He only knew this slightly tipsy girl who seemed to amuse him. And there was something compelling about my new friend. My nerve endings telegraphed, "Run, stupid, run!" messages to my brain, but I ignored them. Even if I ended up chained in a secret basement dungeon, well, it's not as if I had to go to work the next day. When the bartender yelled, "Last call," Gabriel walked me to my car. There was an uncomfortable second when I thought, hoped, he might kiss me. He was staring at my mouth with a sort of hunger that made me feel light and giddy. After a few agonizing seconds, he sighed, opened my car door, and wished me goodnight. I drove slowly along Route 161, pondering my drinking buddy's apparent indifference. Had I ever been the type of girl who got picked up in bars? Well, no. I am the designated girl buddy. If I had a nickel for every time I heard the words, "I don't want to ruin our friendship," I wouldn't be driving a car with an ominously flashing check engine light. As I passed High Station Road, the taste of coffee and mudslides bubbled at the back of my throat with threatening velocity. I verped up essence of Kahlua and mumbled, "Great, I'll finish the night off by vomiting." Then Big Bertha's engine rattled and died. "Oh, crap," I moaned, thunking my head against the wheel. I did not relish the idea of walking alone at night on the proverbial dark country road. But Half Moon Hollow had two towing garages, both of which closed after 8 p.m. I didn't have much of a choice. Plus,
there was also the tiniest possibility that I still had alcohol in my system, so calling the police or AAA was not a great idea. So, out of my car I climbed, grumbling about useless machines and blowtorch revenge. I was wearing open-toed sandals, very sensible shoes when one is schlepping toward a hatchet-wielding, woods-dwelling maniac. I spent every other step kicking bits of gravel out of my shoes, knowing that it was forming impenetrable gray cement between my toes. I passed roadside banks of wild daylilies, their orange lips clenched shut against the night, their heavy heads leaving tracks of dew on my jeans. To top off my evening, I was going to have to check myself for ticks when I got home. The one thing I had going for me was good night vision. I thought so right up until I fell face first into a ditch. "Seriously?" I yelled at the sky. "Come on!" Swiping at the mud on my face and the stones embedded in my knees, I made more creative use of those seven words you don't say in polite company. Lights fanned over me. I spun toward the noise of a moving vehicle, wondering whether it was wise to wave and ask for help. Without warning, I felt a hot punch to my side. My lungs were on fire. I couldn't catch my breath. I pressed a palm against my ribs and felt warm gushes of blood spilling out onto the grass. "Oh, crap," was all I could manage before falling back into the ditch. You're probably wondering what happened to me. I certainly did. Even in the darkness that cradled me like warm, wet cotton, I thought, was that it? Was that my whole life? I'm born, I have an unfortunate permed bangs era, I'm fired, I die? I remember being so sorry that I wasn't able to say goodbye to my family or at least give Adam Morrow a kiss that would have left him inconsolable at my funeral. I was also very sorry about my choice of last words. Then, the movie started. The whole tunnel of light thing is a hallucination, but near-death experience survivors aren't lying when they say your life flashes before your eyes. It's kind of a fast-forwarded highlight reel, complete with hokey music. My soundtrack was a Muzak version of Butterfly Kisses, which is something that I will take to my grave. The This Is Your Life flashbacks allow you to watch yourself being born and dying and all the moments in between. Sitting in church in torturously starched tights, first days of school, sleepovers, camping trips, Christmases, birthdays, final exams, each precious bubble of time slipping from you even as you try to grasp and hold on. Some moments you'd rather forget, such as throwing up on the school bus or the time you skipped your grandpa's funeral to go to the water park with your friends. I swear I'll explain that one later. Near the end of my reel, I watched myself talking to Gabriel and wished I'd had more time with him. I saw us leaving the bar in my car crawling toward home. I saw a close-up of Bud Weiser McElroy driving his beat-up red truck down the highway about 2 miles behind me, drinking his favored Bud Light. I watched my own masterful use of obscenities as I climbed out of my stalled car, Bud following me. I watched as I face-planted into the ditch, which I have to admit even I laughed at. There was a wide shot as Bud caught my hunched, muddied form in his headlights. "Oh, come on," I murmured at the screen as Bud reached for the rifle behind his seat.
"Could be an eight-pointer,"
Bud mumbled, rolling down his passenger window. Another close-up of Bud's face as he squinted in concentration. His fingers squeezed the trigger. I screamed at the screen as I watched myself fall to my knees, utter my oh-so-auspicious epitaph, and slump back into the ditch. Believing he'd missed his quarry, Bud put his truck in gear and lumbered away. I screamed, "He thought I was a freaking deer?" So, that's how I died. A drunk was driving along Route 161 and decided to do some from-the-truck deer hunting. Instead of a nice buck to put up on his wall, he shot a recently fired, far-too-sober-to-die librarian. In the theater of my dying brain, the highlight reel came to a close. I was cold and tired. And then I woke up as one of the undead. Chapter 2. Welcome to the fascinating world of the undead. Please use this guidebook as a handy reference as you make your first steps toward eternity. Inside, you will find information on vampire nutrition, relationships, and safety. But before learning about your future, a word about our past. from the Guide for the Newly Undead. After thousands of years operating right under mortal noses, the great vampire coming out of 2000 wasn't the result of a TV expose, a medical breakthrough, or a chatty vampire interviewee. It was a lawsuit. Some of the undead choose to hold on to their original lives, continuing to work, pay taxes, and floss. In 1999, a recently turned Milwaukee tax consultant named Arnie Frink wanted to continue working for the firm of Jacoby, Myers, and Letts. But the human resources rep, as ignorant as the rest of the world about the existence of the undead, refused to allow Arnie to keep evening hours. Arnie got a fellow vamp with a 200-year-old medical degree to diagnose him with porphyria, a painful allergy to sunlight. But the evil HR rep could not be moved. Even if leaving his condo before sunset left Arnie with second-degree burns and body odor similar to scorched dog hair, he was expected to keep banker's hours. Mr. Jacoby was a bit paranoid about office security. This prevented Arnie from making a living, so to speak, and interfered with his pursuit of happiness. So Arnie did what any red-blooded American would do. He sued. When the allergy discrimination argument failed to impress a judge, a sunblock-slathered Arnie flipped out in court and demanded that his lawyer be fired so he could represent himself. As his indignant counsel slunk away, Arnie declared that he was a vampire, with a medical condition that rendered him unable to work during the day, thereby making him subject to the Americans with Disabilities Act. After Arnie was hauled off by the men in white coats, his vitals were checked, and the doctors noticed that his heart wasn't beating. Plus, he bit a nurse who tried to take his rectal temperature. But I think we can all agree she had that coming. After extensive psych evaluations, the doctors agreed that it was possible that Arnie was telling the truth, but they weren't willing to put it in writing. After several lengthy appeals, Arnie won his lawsuit and got a settlement, evening hours, and an interview with Barbara Walters. The international vampire community was incensed and formally voted to have Arnie staked to an anthill at dawn. But after the media firestorm and the I told you so storm from internet conspiracy nuts, most vampires realized they should have come out a century ago. If nothing else, maybe we all could have avoided the goth movement. A select contingent of ancient vampires from across the globe officially notified the United Nations of their presence on Earth and asked the world's governments to recognize them. They also asked for special leniency in certain medical, legal, and tax issues that were sure to come up. Vampires tend to throw away receipts. The first year or so was chaos. Mobs, pitchforks, the whole deal. The federal government issued mandatory after-dark curfews. Walmart started selling vampire home defense kits, including holy water, crosses, stakes, mallets, and a book of quick blessings to bar vampires from your door. The fact that these kits were generally useless didn't bother me nearly as much as the idea of holy water being sold at Walmart. Humans didn't seem to understand that they lived around vampires all their lives and never realized it, that they had never been attacked before the coming out, never been threatened. And vampires posed even less of a threat now that they had better access to legally marketed blood. Vampires would never get their teenage daughters pregnant or tie up the McDonald's drive-thru. Hell, vampires were less of a threat than Bud McElroy. Nevertheless, vampire safe houses were torched in major cities all over the world. The same international contingent of vampires, who called themselves the World Council for the Equal Treatment of the Undead, appealed to the governments for help. Vampires were given certain global rights in terms of self-defense against angry mobs, but no real progress was made in laws prosecuting said angry mobs. In exchange for vampire public assistance programs, the U.S. federal government demanded a certain amount of information. According to the 2000 National Census, there are 1.3 million vampires residing in the United States. Of course, less than half of the vampires in the United States trusted the federal government enough to participate in the census. In fact, the results showed that 2% of census takers mysteriously disappeared in the course of their duties. The census also showed that 63% of American vampires live in groups of threes and fours. This is called nesting, which vampire behaviorists attribute to their need to bond with other creatures who share their unique needs and abilities.
I believe that even after death, we want someone to assure us that our butts don't look big before we leave the house. Single vampires tend to live alone in historic family homes with a lot of cats. Very few surveyed vampires were willing to disclose where they got their blood. And those who did disclose their food sources gave vague answers, such as willing private donors. That was less of an issue after companies flooded the market with processed artificial blood, which can also be purchased at Walmart. Synthetic blood was originally designed to counteract dwindling American Red Cross donations and support military surgical units. But vampires found they could live a violence-free unlife on the stuff. This, combined with vampire blood banks offering $30 a pint for real human blood, was more than enough to promote those first semi-friendly human-vampire interactions. An unexpected side effect of the great coming out was the emergence of all-night industries to cater to the needs of undead Americans. Electronic stores, delivery services, specialty dentists' offices, window tinting shops, and yes, tax firms. There was a new, skilled, taxable labor force available to work at night. And there were new companies and products such as SPF 500 sunblock and blood banks that actually allowed withdrawals. The economic development was incredible. The recession the government had told us for years that we haven't been having, gone. With the realization that the undead population generated more above-the-table disposable income, vampires were grudgingly accepted into the living world. It took me a while to learn the rules. Okay, it took the librarian in me weeks of careful, obsessive research to learn the rules. There was a label maker involved. I'd rather not go into it. Here's what I learned. Forget what you've heard from the vamp PR firms. Vampires are not suffering from a skin condition that makes them anemic, sensitive to sunlight, and slow to age. Vampires are magical beings, creatures of the night, children of darkness. But don't call them that to their faces. It really pisses them off. The undead are highly sensitive to heat and daylight. Some older vamps can venture out in the day under controlled circumstances with no problem, but since their somewhat unstable molecular structure makes them pretty flammable, you get newbies who spend too much time outdoors and end up as little charcoal briquettes. Every vamp has a different level of reaction. I would find out later that I blister and smell like burnt popcorn, which I hate. That smell never comes out of your clothes. A vamp's sensitivity to religious symbols is directly related to his or her religious participation and ethnic background, BD, before death. Vampire legends and lore predate Christianity by thousands of years. Some vampires wouldn't react if you shoved a rosary down their pants, though I wouldn't recommend testing the theory. For others, every mention of Jesus is like being punched in the forehead. The cross reminds them of what they once were, how far they've fallen away from God's favor, the fact that they will never die. I don't know how I will react yet, so I tend to stay away from churches. As far as I know, vampires still have souls. They have the same capacity for good and evil that humans do. The problem is that the worst can emerge when a person is no longer answering to the no stealing, no hitting, no bloodletting constraints of human society. The bottom line is, if you were a jerk in your original life, you're probably going to be a bigger undead jerk. If you were a decent person, say, a juvenile services librarian with a secret collection of unicorn figurines, you're probably going to be a kinder, gentler vampire. There are rare exceptions, when a repressed person gets turned and goes buck wild and evil. Generally, they calm down after 200 or so years. Or they're beheaded by angry townsfolk. Also, for some reason, vampires tend to wear a lot of leather. Animal rights issues aside, I don't think that's an indicator of evil. When vampires are turned, they buy leather pants. It's kind of like when human men get divorced. They get a sad apartment and a boat. It's a rite of passage. The undead are generally more attractive after being turned. Even vampires who weren't conventionally attractive in life have a certain sensual sparkle. As long as they keep up with basic hygiene, they will stay that way. In order to hunt and feed, they have to be able to attract prey, yes? Chameleons blend in with their surroundings. Anglerfish have those weird dangly bait things hanging off their faces. Vampires have bright eyes, glistening white teeth, a naturally smooth skin, and a certain animal magnetism. If they aren't pretty, they starve. It's sort of like life in Los Angeles. As for the other legends, vamps do not turn into swirls of fog or bats. They can see themselves in mirrors, but not in water, for some reason. They haven't slept in coffins regularly for almost 100 years now. Leaving knots untied and scattering seeds to distract them will only work on vampires with OCD. Garlic can't really hurt them, but they tend to stay away from it because, hello, supersensitive noses. Like most aspects of vampirism, their highly developed sense of smell is both a blessing and a curse. Think about your physiological responses to anger, fear, or even arousal. Sweaty palms, increased body temperature, release of certain pheromones. Well, vamps can smell all of that. So if you're a jumpy slayer wannabe with plans to stake your first bloodsucker, they can peg you at about 50 paces. The drawback is that layer upon layer of emotions and people can be overwhelming and, if dealing with stinky, fear-based feelings, pretty unpleasant. Vampires are allergic to silver. Touching it feels like a combination of burning, itching, and being forced to lick dry ice. If you want to repel attacking vampires, just tell them you've had recent dental work. They are not invulnerable. A stake through the heart, decapitation, and setting them on fire will kill them, but that would kill most anybody. You don't become a vampire just by being bitten. Otherwise, the world would be overrun with bloodsuckers. To make a child, a vampire will feed on a victim until he or she reaches the point of death. This is quite an effort, considering that vampires don't usually drink much more than a pint at a time. The vampire must be careful, as drinking too much can leave the initiate unconscious and unable to drink the blood that will change him or her. I know it sounds gross, but when faced with death by sudden gunshot wound, it's a tempting offer. The process takes a lot out of the vampire sire and is said to be the closest the undead can come to childbirth. It's why a vampire will only turn a handful of children in his or her lifetime. After taking the sire's blood, the new vampire dies. The heart stops beating, the body shuts down. For 3 days, he or she is actually dead. In some very unpleasant cases, newbies have been embalmed and buried by mistake. I once asked an older vampire what happens to the embalmed vamps, but he just glowered at me and muttered some undead curse word. So, in a way, it's a good thing that no one found my body. Right? After my death, I woke up in a stranger's bedroom. There were soft, deep blues in the carpet over the polished pine floors, in the thick drapes drawn across the windows. The room was gently lit by an old Riverstone fireplace. Strange in August. Wood carvings, brass knick-knacks, polished bits of glass, little touches that spoke of years of travel, were scattered around the room with a careless sort of charm. Despite the sluggish pace my brain was keeping, this was alarming. I probably should have mentioned that at this point I had not had sex in about 3 years. That's right, a 27-year-old, almost virgin, librarian. Take time to absorb the cliché. It's not that I didn't have opportunities for sex. I had plenty of offers from bad dates, anonymous callers with breathing problems, various construction workers. But beyond a rather regrettable, let's just get it over with, encounter with a fellow virgin and close friend Dave Chandler my sophomore year of college, and an even more regrettable, my first time was awful, maybe it would be better with someone with more experience, experiment with a teaching assistant my senior year, my sexual repertoire was somewhat limited. My problem with sex was, along with most of my problems, rooted in my brain. My head was always speeding ahead of my libido. I could never relax enough to let nature take its course. And there was just plain bad sex. My partner mistaking me yelling when I caught my hair on his watch band for cries of passion, having to go to the emergency room for a broken nose when Justin Tyler headbutted me, the guy who got a mid-thrust leg cramp and whined to the point that I walked out of his apartment half-dressed. I always hoped for this spark of chemistry and compatibility, a flash of clarity to let me know that this was the guy, this was the time, so I should let go and enjoy myself. But it rarely came. And by no small coincidence, neither did I. Between these extremely unsatisfying experiences and my apparent inability to develop that spark with any man on the planet, I just decided sex wasn't worth the effort. If I wanted to spend an evening half-dressed, humiliated, and unfulfilled, I'd try amateur night down at the booby hatch. So I channeled my energy into my work at the library and obsessively collecting obscure BBC movies on DVD. The Woman in White with Justine Waddle is a life changer. So, after years of relative inactivity, the idea that I had participated and possibly been videotaped in some drunken one-night stand with an over-decorating stranger was upsetting. The most print-friendly version of my first undead words was, "What did I do?" I sat up and found that I was wearing clothes, which was good, but I was wearing striped cotton pajamas that were not my own, which was bad. My brain, my throat, my mouth, everything above my shoulders felt swollen and detached. Swallowing was an effort. I struggled to get my feet over the edge of the bed. I took some solace in the fact that I had been debauched in a well-appointed bed. I rolled off the marshmallow of a mattress and flopped face down on the floor. Ow. "Misery, thy name is Mudslide," I groaned. I braced myself against another tasteful piece, a cherry dresser with a high, narrow mirror. My considerable height allowed my head to rest just below the frame, against the soothing cool of the glass. As my eyes slowly came to focus, I thought it must have been an old mirror or some sort of carnival trick, because I was stunning. My skin was clear, lineless, even iridescent in the low light. I was practically a Noxzema girl. My teeth were straighter somehow, and a bright, unnatural white. My eyes, usually a muddy hazel, were pure amber. My hair had gone from plain, straight-as-a-board brown to long waves of glistening chestnut with undertones of honey and auburn. And if I wasn't mistaken, my butt looked smaller and higher. "She finally did it," I screeched, clutching my cotton-covered rear. "Mama tranquilized me and booked me on Extreme Makeover." I opened my shirt to see if there was any change to my breasts. I'd always secretly hoped for a slightly fuller C-cup. No luck.
"What's Extreme Makeover?"
I made a sound not quite human and ended up clinging to the ceiling, my fingernails dug into the plaster like a frightened cartoon cat, and I was looking at an inverted version of Gabriel, the tequila sunrise drinker.
"You,"
I hissed.
"Yes?"
Gabriel asked, making himself comfortable in a handsomely upholstered wingback chair.
"Date rapist,"
I yelled, wondering how to tumble off the ceiling and find the mace in my purse in less than 3 strides. Clearly, this was not the response he was expecting.
"I beg your pardon?
What the hell did you give me?" Gabriel arched an eyebrow.
"Give you?
Must have been some pretty powerful drugs to make me forget an entire night and then cling to the frickin' ceiling," I shouted. Some little voice in the back of my brain wondered exactly how my hands and knees were sticking to the ceiling, but since I was far more interested in whatever illegal substances might be in my system, I demanded, "Now what did you give me?"
"I think it would be best if you came down from there before I explained that."
"I think I'll stay right where I am, thank you," I said. "And you stay where you are, or I don't know what I'll do, but it will really hurt. You, I mean." He grinned. It was not a friendly smile, more of a "poor pitiful creature whom I'm about to devour, you amuse me" sort of smile. A very white, very pointy smile, set in an unnaturally pale face. This was when it dawned on me that I was dealing with a member of our less-than-living population.
"You're a vampire,"
I exclaimed. Not the most original or astute of observations, I'll admit, but I was hanging upside down. I can't emphasize that enough. Gabriel offered that disturbing grin again.
"Yes, and so are you."
I'm not sure how long I hung there staring at him. Eventually, I found my talking to preschoolers voice and drawled, "No, I'm a librarian. Or at least, I used to be before I got fired today or yesterday, whatever day it is. You stay right there," I cried, scrambling back across the ceiling as he leaned forward. I had to admit, despite the weird, whooshy feeling in my head, that was pretty cool.
"I wouldn't dream of moving,"
he said, sitting back again.
"Perhaps you'd like to come down?"
"No, Wah!" Whatever tentative grip I had on the plaster failed, and I landed safely on my feet. I straightened my pajama top. I think I will get down. Thank you.
So glad you could join me.
My undead host motioned for me to sit across from him. I plopped down in the seat, pulling anxiously at the pajama top to make sure everything was covered.
You're a very unusual young woman.
You're not the first person to say that.
I'm sure that's true.
He nodded. I was just hanging from the ceiling, right? That wasn't a PCP-induced hallucination, I asked. He shook his head. How exactly did I do that?
You'll be surprised what you're capable of, particularly when you're startled.
He smiled warmly.
You know, your mind is a fascinating instrument. It's jam-packed up there. Even now, in the throes of panic, you're observing, cataloging the information for later. I find that intriguing.
Well, thank you for noticing, I said, standing up. I am going home now and pouring every drop of alcohol in my house down the drain. In a flash of movement, he was at my side. His cool fingers stroked my forehead. I wanted to move, to dodge those long, elegant hands. Instead, I sat transfixed, letting him stream his fingers down my cheeks. His lips hovered near my ear, and he whispered, "Remember." I was watching movies in my head again. I saw it all, remembered everything in a hot rush of oily color. I watched lights fade as I lay dying in the ditch. Gabriel was there, cradling me in his arms. I was drifting in that gray, misty world bordering on unconsciousness, but I could hear, I could see. He asked if I wanted to die. I shook my head, so weak, too weak to even manage, "Duh." He pressed his face to my throat. I cried out as his teeth pierced my skin. I ripped the seams of his shirt front as my whole body clenched. I dully registered the sound of his buttons plinking against the gravel. There was an insistent pressure as he drew my blood to the wound. After Gabriel took a few long drinks, it didn't hurt anymore. I couldn't even feel the gash in my side. I was floating. I was warm. I was safe. Gabriel pulled away from me, leaving me cold, exposed. I whimpered, lamely trying to pull him back to my neck. That was embarrassing to watch. And it was also the point where it got weird. Snarling, Gabriel bit into his wrist and held it over my mouth. Even in memory, I was disgusted. The feeling of his cool, coppery blood dripping past my lips was repulsive, but I couldn't stop it. I knew at a primal, instinctual level that I needed it to survive. He whispered encouragements in a watery language I couldn't understand. I swallowed, thinking of what was flowing over my tongue as medicine. And soon, I didn't care. I claimed his wrist, pressing it to my mouth and devouring. I was drowning, filling the crushing void that threatened to take me down with it. I couldn't think. I couldn't draw enough breath no matter how hard I tried. Gently, Gabriel pried me away from his arm. He murmured against my forehead as I writhed, my brain screaming for air. I screamed noiselessly, hot tears streaming down my cheeks. Gabriel's eyes held me, cradling me in their sympathy. In English, he whispered that this part was never easy, but it would be over soon. My heartbeat slowed to nothing. One last shallow gasp rattled in my chest. Everything was dark. I was ripped out of the vision and into reality. I tumbled to my knees. If there was anything in my stomach, I would have gladly tossed it up onto the carpet. "What did you do to me?" I whispered, shaking away the memory and wiping at my mouth.
"You know what I am. You know what you are," he said quietly,
as if we were talking about being Episcopalian.
"I offered you a choice, and you took it."
I shot him what I hoped was a truly scathing glare. Some choice. I was dying. Some drunk shot me from a pickup. Why couldn't I have just woken up with gonorrhea like every other girl of loose moral fiber? He barked out a laugh.
"You're very funny."
I chose to accept that as a compliment and move on. "Thanks. Well, I've got to go." I'd taken about half a step toward the bedroom door. Gabriel was blocking my path. How did he move like that? It was really irritating.
"You can't leave," he said, closing his hands around my wrists.
He seemed to enjoy the contact, judging from the way his eyes darkened and flashed. It was an epic struggle to ignore the drool-worthiness of the man currently stroking my cheek. Remembering that he'd just given me what amounted to an internal hickey helped considerably.
"You need to feed soon. It's been 3 days since you've taken anything at all.
I'm not taking anything from you. I shoved him back, even as my mind raced. 3 days? He couldn't be serious. No one can sleep for 3 days.
Oh, right. I was dead. New rules. You must drink, Jane.
I won't.
This could be much more difficult. I'm trying to make it easy on you, he said, advancing on me.
I don't think that's possible, I said, pressing my hand against his chest to keep him away. It was like touching a brick wall, hard, immovable, and lifeless. There was no heartbeat beneath my palm, no breath.
This was not good.
You have to feed. There are things we need to discuss, he murmured.
He moved closer, running the tip of his nose along my hairline. That worried me, considering the 3-day bathing hiatus. But my general odor didn't seem to bother him. Quite the contrary. He pulled my hand low, dragging me against him. I desired nothing more than to lean into him, let him wrap me in those long arms, and drink from him until I couldn't care anymore. And then my stupid logical brain piped up. I didn't know this guy. I didn't even know where I was, really. For all I knew, I was having some sort of bizarre allergic reaction to the GHB he'd slipped me. And now I was going to let him slobber all over me? No. Stay away from me. I threw him into a wall. Hard. Hard enough to knock some attractive watercolors off the plaster and to the floor. I grabbed my purse, which was conveniently placed by the front door. Gabriel was such a considerate abductor host. He even left the front door unpadlocked. The sun had just set, leaving a muggy, late summer evening in its wake. The scent of growth, quiet and green, hung heavy in the air. I heard everything. I saw everything. I could count the craters on the moon. I could count every mosquito buzz past, bypassing my tender skin out of respect for a fellow bloodsucker. I heard the rustle of every leaf on every tree. I could feel animals in the woods, scuttling through the grass. Dark things, feeding, running, feasting. And I envied them.
Jane!
Gabriel was framed in the front door. He did not seem happy. I'm not a spring-into-action sort of girl. And yet I was dashing headlong into the woods like an over-caffeinated gazelle. I bounded through the trees, sensing animals stop and watch me as I sprinted by. I laughed into the wind, amazed at this new freedom. I broke into an easy lope when I could no longer sense Gabriel behind me. I stayed away from the main roads, vaulting over barbed wire fences and through pastures. I disturbed Hank Yancey's cattle enough to send him running to his front porch with a shotgun. It took about 2 miles before it registered that my feet were bare and stinging, but even that felt good. I'd never felt so alive, so aware, so ravenously hungry. I finally understood those crazy people who talked about runner's highs. I bounded up the front steps of River Oaks, the 147-year-old pre-Civil War farmhouse I inherited from my great-aunt Jetty, and threw myself on the living room sofa, dazed and laughing. I had to figure out what the hell to do next. First order of business, I was starving. Where did a vampire get her very first breakfast? I was evaluating the overall ick factor of that statement when Zeb Lavelle, my best friend since first grade, strode into my living room.
Janie, where the hell have you been?
Chapter 3. There are many alternatives to drinking human blood, including synthetic blood and animal blood. Warm-blooded animals, such as pigs or cows, are recommended, as reptilian blood tends to be bitter. In order to make synthetic or animal blood more palatable, we suggest microwaving it for 38 seconds at 75% power. Dropping a penny into the blood after microwaving also gives it an authentic coppery taste. From the guide for the newly undead.
Wait, Zeb said, pulling me off the couch and wrapping me in his long, gangly arms. I could smell traces of aftershave on his skin and French onion sun chips on his breath. I could feel the blood coursing through his veins, see the staccato beat of his pulse at his throat. Zeb was oblivious to these disturbing developments.
I'm really glad you're okay. What's with the pajamas?
Seriously, where have you been? He demanded.
I heard about you getting fired on Wednesday, and I came here Wednesday to see how you were doing, but you weren't here. Did I mention that was on Wednesday? I can understand you needed a self-pity bender, Jane, but you have to let someone know where you are. I've been feeding your psychotic dog for 3 days. Your mom's been going nuts, and you know that means she's been calling me. I've been able to hold her off from calling the police for this long, but I'll feel bad if some pajama fetish freak has been keeping you in his basement this whole time. Stop! I thundered, my voice pitching to a deep smoker's tenor. The raspy command seemed to settle Zeb down pretty quickly. He dropped to the couch waiting for my next command. It was the first time in more than 20 years of friendship that he was completely silent and still. I'm fine. I cleared my throat and returned to my normal voice, pushing the words around the strange stretching sensation in my mouth. My teeth felt as if they were growing. Everything is fine. Wait, you already heard I got fired? Emerging from his stupor, Zeb shot me a look both pitiful and withering. Coming from Zeb, it wasn't that intimidating. Picture Steve Zahn with big brown eyes and less impulse control. It's the Hollow, Jane. The whole town knows you got fired. Oh, that's not good, I said, sinking next to him. Oh, it's okay, he said, putting his arm around me again. I've told everybody you were fired because Mrs. Stubblefield was afraid you'd take her job, and that you had proof that she was drinking at her desk. Zeb grinned, clearly thrilled with his own cleverness. Thanks, Zeb. I nestled into the curve of his neck. He stiffened. This was not a normal move for me. We were in the strictly no-nookie, personal-space-respecting category of platonic friendship. Just one little nip, a sly voice told me. He'll barely feel it. Drink your fill. He might even enjoy it. I could picture his veins opening to me, pouring his blood over my lips, like drinking straight from a bottle of Hershey syrup. My tongue stretched out to trace the path of his jugular. Janie, I know you're upset about your job and everything, but I don't think this is the way to go, he said, prying my hands away. Every muscle burned in the grip of my thirst, jumping under the skin. I clutched his shirt, tearing it as I pulled him to me. I'm sorry, Zeb. I'm just so hungry. He laughed, a nervous noise that jangled my nerves. I could smell his fear, a thick tang of adrenaline over the sweat breaking out on his lip. My stomach rumbled in response. Zeb blanched. How about we order a pizza? My treat? I clamped my hands over Zeb's and pressed him back against the cushions. Zeb, I don't want to hurt you, but I will.
Jane.
I whirled, and, I am ashamed to say, hissed as Gabriel threw open my front door. He swept into the room with the slow-motion, flowy-coated elegance you only see in the Matrix movies. Zeb gave a girlish shriek as Gabriel threw me off him and across the room.
Sleep,
Gabriel told him. Zeb slumped over, and his face melted from blind, twitching terror to blissful slumber.
What do you think you're doing?
I demanded, righting myself from my tumble into the cold, dark fireplace.
This has nothing to do with you.
It has everything to do with me,
he shouted, so loudly that I felt the echo bouncing around my skull.
I am your sire. I am to guide you through your first days as a vampire. Your first feeding is a rite of passage, a sacrament. It will not be wasted on some hormone-driven frenzy. This is why I wanted you to feed from me.
I will not drink it in a house. I will not drink it with a mouse. I will not drink it here or there. I will not drink it anywhere, I wheezed, hoping I was able to communicate adequate sarcasm through the crippling belly cramps.
Did you just quote Green Eggs and Ham?
For future reference, my sire did not appreciate being silently flipped the bird by his panting, twitching protege.
Jane,
he said, gripping my shoulder so hard I felt my bones buckle.
My sire sent me out into the world with nothing. I was left in a root cellar to rise alone and ignorant. My thirst was maddening, bottomless. I came upon a couple of sharecroppers sitting on their front porch, enjoying the cool of the evening. I didn't know how much I could drink. I didn't realize how fragile they were.
You killed them? Gabriel nodded.
I didn't know any better. I wasn't prepared for what happened. This man is your friend, your closest friend in the entire world. I wouldn't have you start your life as a vampire with such regrets.
But I'm so hungry, I whined. I feel like I'm going crazy.
It's like nothing you've ever felt or will feel again.
he said, smiling sadly. You're being consumed from the inside out. All you can think of is feeding, filling up that emptiness. Let me make it easier for you, he said. I've fed recently. I can nourish you.
That's what they all say, I said, slumping to my knees. My throat was closing up. I couldn't swallow, couldn't concentrate long enough to remember that I didn't need to breathe. Go away. This is too...
His hands were at the base of my head, pressing my mouth to his throat. I groaned, repulsed, but still drawn as he dragged his nails across his jugular. I resisted, but the smell of his skin and of the blood dripping from his wound was like freshly baked brownies. It sounds bizarre, but I'm trying to put it into terms of a smell humans can understand. It was as if I'd been sequestered on a fat farm for 3 days and someone was waving Godiva under my nose. I wanted Gabriel's blood. I needed it with the instinctual urgency I'd felt on the side of the road. It was revolting and compelling. I reached out, tentatively stretching to catch the first falling drops with the tip of my tongue. My teeth ached. That new stretching sensation, I realized, was my fangs extending. I scraped them across Gabriel's throat, sinking into the skin. The blood gushed, lukewarm, over my lips. I swear I purred, relaxing into the curve of him. He wrapped my hair around his fist and pulled me closer. I lapped at the wound, lazily nuzzling his cheek. He sighed and rubbed my back, whispering to me. I had flashes of images. At first I couldn't tell whether they were from my head or Gabriel's. I think they were a mix of both. Gabriel reaching for my hand in the bar, squeezing it. Gabriel walking me to my car and the sad smile he gave me as I drove away from the restaurant. Big Bertha's taillights in the distance as Gabriel followed me home on that dark stretch of road. Gabriel's lips moving, telling me everything was going to be all right as I took my last breath. Gabriel watching over me as I slept in his house, reading passages from Emma aloud as he waited for me to rise. When my stomach was finally filled, I pulled away. Gabriel grumbled a quiet protest.